Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
So, obvious question, this seems like a bit of a departure from writing books about CrossFit Hills and Ashley Young.
It is. I mean, they're possibly not the sexiest band in rock history, although I seem to remember Neil Young did win a contest in an American teen magazine about 1970 as having the sexiest rock star body.
Oh, right.
In other words, he weighed about 4 stone. Yes.
So how did you get to this?
How did I get to this? Well, one of the books we talked about, probably at the Islington, about 5 or 6 years ago, was called Electric Shock, which was about the whole history of popular music, 125 years worth. And I started to realise how much of that history is to do with sex. Dancing has stuff to do with sex. The relationship between the singer, the performer, and the audience. And when you think about it, pop, I mean, the main reason for pop is to A, to get people dancing, and B, to get young people sexually excited. Now, that might not have worked with Atomic Rooster or Jethro Tull flute solos or whatever, but
you'd be wrong.
Well, we'll talk about your taste later on in that case. But that was a more sort of cerebral offshoot. Pop is about sex, basically. So it kept coming up in my research, so to speak. But also, my long-standing friendship with the late, unfortunately, Johnny Rogan, fellow writer. He and I think before Jimmy Savile had got singled out, we kept, in our various researches into pop's past, kept coming across rather dodgy stuff to do with underage girls, particularly, and we would sort of point these things out to each other. And that was really the first seed for the book that you can see up there, which is, it's not anti-60s. I didn't want to be that person like Norman Tebbit who thought the 60s was appalling. I love the 60s, I love the music, the fashion I'm a bit old for, possibly now, but films, the culture, the political culture particularly, that still inspires me. But the more I delve into the cultural sort of output of the 60s, newspapers, magazines, films, books, you realise how dodgy it is by current standards. And that's not just because we've all become so fantastically careful about everything. It's outrageously blatant. If you look at newspapers in the early 60s, after the book and the film of Lolita are published, I mean, it's just underage girls are fair game. If underage girls are having sex with old men, it's the underage girls' fault for leading the poor men astray. And it's there in almost every newspaper, almost every magazine. And the connection back to pop was I was looking at the girls' magazine Boyfriend, which was probably aimed at, in the early 60s, probably aimed at, I don't know, 13 to 16. And these days that would be the equivalent of about 8 to 11, I should think. So they weren't talking about sex, but they were talking about boys fancying girls and so on. And the advice column was always awful. If a boy's trying to have sex with you, you shouldn't be leading him on. And then they did a profile in 1962, before he was famous, really, in this country, of Jimmy Savile. And there's a quote in there about Jimmy Savile. In Jimmy Savile's world, you get away with everything you can. And with Jimmy Savile, he can get away with anything, you know. And it was just like, well, that's his whole modus operandi exposed in that quote, being aimed at teenage girls. So that was really the start of it. It sort of grew out of the pop research. And then I realised you couldn't write a history of sex, every bit of sex in the 60s, because it would be very boring. And everybody's experience of sex in the 60s was very different. And so I picked out 12 sort of representative stories to give sort of different perspectives on the 60s.
Well, a lot of it's about the arrival of kind of sexual freedom versus the kind of Victorian rectitude of the disapproving, hand-wringing press, you know. And we just put a picture up here, actually, of Mick Jagger and Mary Whitehouse on the David Frost show, which sums it up perfectly, doesn't it? So explain what was happening there in when they appeared on television.
Well, they would have been debating the Permissive Society.
Yes.
Which we all remember very well.
Yeah.
And I suppose one of the things about my book is that it didn't just permit freedom, it also permitted exploitation. But in this instance, Mick Jagger is obviously the representative of everything permissive, because he was having sex with Marianne Faithfull and they weren't even married. And Mary Whitehouse, I'm sure almost everybody in this room will remember as the bastion of Christianity, moral rectitude, conservatism. And so certainly when I was a kid, or you know, in my 20s and 30s, I thought A, she was dangerous, she was a crank. Anybody remember the Gay News thing where she tried to get Gay News magazine shut down because there was a blasphemous poem in it? And I thought she was a joke as well. And then you read what she actually wrote and you delve into her background, and she was a secondary school teacher who, for her sins, was in the early 60s given the role of being the sex ed teacher. And so she had all these confused boys and girls, 12, 13, 14, coming to her saying, "I don't understand, please help. I've seen this, you know, I watched this play on TV last night and it was all full of sex," which I'm sure it wasn't in 1963, but in their heads it was. And so her fundamental sort of rationale the whole time was, will anybody think of the children? And so she was always concerned about the welfare of the children. And by the time I finished writing a chapter about her, I mean, I pick out all the most ridiculous things in her crusade. But at the end of a chapter, I end up saying, well, actually, maybe she was a better moral guardian for kids in the 60s than the editor of Oz, Richard Neville, and they bumped into each other in 1970. And in 70 or 80 or 90, I would have picked Richard Neville's philosophy, obviously. But in retrospect, now looking back and seeing the rest of the culture around, well, actually, she wasn't as evil as everybody thought she was.
The 60s ended up going into posterity as associated with sex, didn't it? You know, I've got the famous, you know, Philip Larkin poem in front of me here. "Sexual intercourse began in 1963... which was rather late for me.
Slightly early for me, because I was only six.
There you go. Between the end of the Chatterley Band and the Beatles' first LP.
Which is wonderful and completely untrue, I think. I'm sure Larkin must have felt it was happening around him. And actually, wasn't he screwing his secretary or something?
I believe so, yes.
But
why this association between, you know, we don't associate the 50s with sex at all, do we, in the same way?
Although there's Diana Dawes on the left, who was Britain's Marilyn Monroe from the 50s. The 60s, I mean, what changed sexually in the 60s was not so much what ordinary people were doing in Scunthorpe or Bognor Regis, where I now live, but the culture. And so you went from 1960, where you couldn't discuss anything about sex in public. You certainly couldn't see anything nude in a newspaper or in a movie or on television, until by the end of a decade, and we're all old enough to remember this, suddenly Play for Today, there's nudity almost every week.
Yeah.
BBC Two are showing all these very arty films. I got to see Jean-Luc Godard and Ingmar Bergman films because I was looking for sex. Just by the by, I got a fantastic education in European 1960s cinema as well. But to the change, I don't think there's ever been a time in history where the sort of rules of censorship have changed as quickly as they did. Between 1960, no sex, please, we're British. 1970, we're basically in culture, anything goes.
Yes, yeah. But still, I mean, I'm really interested in this point. You know, there's something like Mick Jagger and you know, led to famous people at the time, were living a life that the rest of the country just couldn't imagine.
And
the majority of the rest of the country was still quite conservative, weren't they? Tell us about that. I mean, you know, the
did people think it was okay to have sex before marriage? Did most people think that in the mid-60s?
Most people certainly didn't think that. One or two sexologists and sex ed writers were starting to suggest, even one or two bishops came out and said, well, maybe it's not the worst thing in the world to have sex before you're married, and it might be good to find out if you love this other person sexually before you marry them. And there would be outrage in the popular press, and Mary Whitehouse would obviously be outraged because she was always outraged. But I think it was only really in the 70s, from experience of me and friends and people around us, that suddenly it was a lot more open. And yeah, I mean, I tend to think in the late 60s, people were having sex in Chelsea, maybe to have kids, but otherwise nobody was having sex at all.
And then the reason for that was what?
In the early 60s, you had the pill, and you think, well, great, that has absolutely liberated women. But first of all, as far as I know, you had to be married. It was quite a long time after that before you were allowed to get the pill. So you would have people pretending to be married and going to their doctors trying to get it. There were lots of health scares, even in the 60s, about whether it was going to cause cancer or heart attacks or whatever. Lots of doctors refused to give people the pill. And then there's the age-old thing of young men thinking, oh, well, you can be on the pill, so therefore you should sleep with me, whether you want to or not. So that was one big problem. There was a huge venereal disease. I can't believe I'm talking about this. A huge venereal disease problem. They did TV documentaries about it in the late 50s and early 60s. Newspapers would give over the whole of the front page to the Ministry of Health to put out a sort of scare story about gonorrhea and syphilis, because I guess there weren't antibiotics that could deal with it or something. I don't know. I mean, it's just... And obviously then, the 80s, we get AIDS, but there's a sort of... What we thought was a golden period,
yeah,
in the
70s. Window, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, where suddenly you could go and get contraceptives without being arrested, and you could have sex without dying, it seemed.
But you couldn't, as we were discussing earlier, you couldn't check into a hotel with your boyfriend or girlfriend without registering as Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
No, well, if I'd had a boyfriend, I certainly couldn't have checked in with a boyfriend.
No,
could. Although we were talking about this earlier as well, I don't think 90% of the population even thought about homosexuality at any point.
No, we'll come to that.
Yeah, but no, you couldn't go into any hotel in the country, I should think, and say, I am Mr. Smith and this is Miss Jones, because they just wouldn't give you a room.
Yeah, which is not the impression people would get when they see the 60s depicted in movies nowadays, where it appears to be, you know, sex in the streets or whatever. It wasn't like that at all. You know, most people were living back in the 50s. Let's just talk for a minute about the 50s and the early 60s. You talk about Cliff Richard in your book, don't you?
I don't talk about him in the way you might be thinking I'm talking about.
No, we're gone. But, you know, Cliff Richard, interesting, you know, the kind of Britain's first pop star, really, of the rock and roll
he's
era.
Well, he's sexier than Tommy Steer, wasn't he? You can see there.
It's interesting. We don't think, Dave and I talked about this earlier, that did Britain really do sexy very well in the late 1950s? It did. Britain didn't quite understand the notion of sexiness. I mean, Europe did, America did. But,
yeah.
But there's a picture in your book of Cliff, you know, in a pair of pyjamas, you know, topless, in fact, you know, trying to kind of beefcake. And it doesn't quite work.
He looks like something out of the Little Woods catalogue, doesn't
it,
really?
He does.
He looks as if he's advertising fine wincy air rather than anything that might be going on.
And also, you say beefcake. This was the kind of photograph that was in gay magazines, although...
people wouldn't have known.
No, that's right. But people who are interested in that kind of thing knew that they could go to certain bookshops in London and buy small, rather grubby little magazines full of topless men or men standing strategically behind columns with no clothes
on. Yeah.
But enough of health and efficiency, which, you know, some of us may remember. One of the in the vanguard of the apparent kind of sexual loosening up in Britain in the 60s, it all seemed to be James Bond. You know, that people were allowed to indulge that side of their interests via James Bond. Do you think that's true? Did that strike you?
Yes, in the books differently to in the films, because obviously the films were aimed at a mass audience and children were being encouraged. So there would be sex, but they would always cut away, or maybe who was in the films in the early 60s? Honor Blackman, was she one?
Honor Blackman and Ursula Andress.
Right, okay. And maybe their clothes would fall away and you'd see them from the back and then it would cut.
Yeah.
Whereas in the books it would be a lot more specific and a lot more sexist as well.
Yeah. Casino Royale being the classic example, doesn't it? Absolutely extraordinary. Have you ever read Casino Royale?
Oh, yes, yeah.
I mean, that's still shocking today. It's absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was... It was also... The James Bond thing was part of the kind of... the sexification of the British entertainment industry, wasn't it? At that point, the people overseas started to identify England with, you know, swinging and sexy and getting away with things that they couldn't get away with in America. Is that the case?
Yes, exactly. And I can't remember the exact coincidence, but there is a date. Maybe it's when Love Me Do comes out that the first James Bond film comes out.
Yeah, it does.
Right, okay, something like that. So there's this association then goes worldwide of all the young, sexy people in Britain, which would have been... quite a surprise to most of the young people in Britain at the time, who probably weren't feeling remotely sexy. And well, certainly at the start of the decade, men were still wearing what their fathers had worn. In some cases, literally, I should think, just hand-me-down suits and so on. But yes, and then you get Carnaby Street, the whole sort of cult of mid-60s fashion and the miniskirt.
How important is the miniskirt?
It was important enough for people to... arrest people in various parts of Europe if they wore miniskirts, for girls to be told at I can't remember if it was Oxford or Cambridge that they mustn't wear a miniskirt to their finals because it would put the poor male students off. There's a whole chapter in my book about fashion hinged around the topless dress. I mean, I'm too young to remember this. Do you vaguely remember this?
Well, I never saw a topless dress. I read a lot about topless dresses.
Well, it was the summer of 64 when I would have been interested in just getting into football and cricket and stuff. But apparently out there in the world, women everywhere were wearing topless dresses. And of course they weren't. Some women were buying topless dresses, but I don't think they ever actually wore them.
So much of this is to do with what's apparently happening out there in the world, isn't it?
It's always somewhere else.
It's always somewhere else. And the reason you haven't seen it is you've gone to bed too early or you live in the wrong place and so forth. Out in Chelsea, it's all going crazy, if you only knew.
And it probably was.
It might well have been. Yeah. It took off so rapidly. There's a lot in your book about sex. No, the whole idea. Yeah, well, I suppose the whole idea of kind of sexual freedom, you know. And there's a lot in the book about Diana Rigg and in the Avengers. It's really interesting that, and you make the point that it's to do with perversion and it's to do with kind of kinkiness. And the sexiness of the Avengers, a lot of it's to her being tied to railway tracks, isn't it? And tied to docking stools and put in medieval stocks and things. There's an element of pain and suffering, you know. It's very extraordinary.
I am old enough to remember that episode of the Avengers. I'm maybe 9 or 10. The one where Mrs. Peel, probably wearing something like that, is tied to a ducking stool and ducked. And I watched it with my Nana, who then would have been 66, and she was a very naughty woman. And I think she'd had sex. And she watched it with me, and she said, "Ooh, kinky." Which actually, for a grandmother in 1966 or 67, is quite something. And that stuck in my head. And it was only then watching it as I grew up that I suddenly thought, "Oh, that's interesting." And then watching it now, you go, bloody hell, it's S&M meets bondage. Yeah, it's amazing.
It is. It's extraordinary.
It's extraordinary, the power of the word kink back in those days. Yeah. You know, obviously the kinks, kinky boots, you know, kinky fashion, kinky tastes and so forth. And nobody quite knew what it was. Nobody knew what it meant. It was exciting to talk about it, you know, because it was... I suppose what we nowadays would call transgressive, wasn't it? Yeah. You know, within the context of a very conventional society.
And isn't it amazing in retrospect that there was a band called The Kinks?
Yeah.
And that they got away with it and they were popular without anybody ever actually saying, "What does that mean?" Yeah. It was just another name, like Beatles or Hollies or whatever. Yeah.
But then a lot of their songs were about exactly what they were talking about.
Yeah. Let's talk about the association of music with sex. And there's a particular example that you talk about in your book as a famous book that I've never read, but you know it's been famous ever since I was about 16, which is Groupie by Jenny Fabian. And the whole business of you know that guys in bands had groupies, and that was a very exciting idea suddenly, wasn't it, for everybody?
I mean, looking back, it's pretty obvious. I mean, we now know that maybe the Beatles didn't entirely behave themselves on tour, and that probably every other pop star in the world, I don't know how far back we go, maybe, you know, perhaps in 1932, Bing Crosby was having groupies. It's quite possible. But certainly in the 60s, there were, you know, sort of well-documented stories.
Who were the pop stars the groupie was meant to be about? Was it the Floyd?
Floyd, yeah, because she was friends with Sid Barrett.
That's right, yeah.
And I think there's a sort of very overt sexual scene at the start, and I think it's him.
Yeah.
Because he's a very pretty rock star with long flowing hair. And yeah.
But it made the whole... It changed people's view of what rock music might promise.
Mm. In America you then get the, what they call GTOs, that group that were sort of pushed by Frank Zappa. There's a whole groupie issue of Rolling Stone magazine in 69 or 70. And it becomes a cult thing to do. And then we get into, which I don't really talk about in the book, the early 70s, and you get celebrity groupies, not just Miss Pamela and Miss Christine from the GTOs, but girls like Sable Starr. And I say girls because they were 13 or 14.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they were very friendly with some of the biggest rock stars in the world, who I better not name because it's probably libelous. But in retrospect now, you think, well, how come they weren't arrested for that? Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. Jane Birkin's enormous hit record of what year are we talking about?
69.
So it's towards the end of the 60s. This was a number one record, which was apparently too rude to be played on the BBC.
And I was saying earlier there was an instrumental version called, I think, does anybody know, was it Love at First Sight? That was a hit at the same time because the tune was so lovely. And if anybody is too young, I'm looking at my daughter there, not to have heard this record, it's a very unrealistic account of having sex with some very interesting imagery in French. I mean, you were doing some translation for us earlier, Mark.
I was, yes. I can remember looking it up at the time, actually. And it was all about entering between your loins, you know. So they're pretty graphic lyrics.
You put your hand up, your eyes there.
I'm embarrassed to tell you this. But the thing that was kind of as revolutionary as the sound of the record was the name of the record. It's Je t'aime, moi non plus, which meant I love you, me neither.
Yeah.
Which is pretty amazing, really, because it made absolutely clear that sex did not require any kind of emotional attachment at all.
And we were talking earlier about was this played on the radio at the time, and it certainly wasn't. And the pirate stations were gone by 69, I think, so they wouldn't have played it. But it was played in my school classroom when I was about 12, because we had an end of term. We had a music teacher. The one thing I can remember she taught me was that I've made bigger boys than you cry, which in retrospect does make you think, I wonder how she did
it.
But at the time, it was just like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And so at the end of term, we were allowed to bring records in. And I was a nice boy and didn't have any records. But somebody brought in Abbey Road, and so I heard Maxwell Silver Hammer for the first time, and thought, that's okay. And then somebody brought in this record, which starts off, and it's a very pleasant tune. And then it goes about 45 seconds in, and then...
And I can almost hear the stylus being ripped off his record now.
And that was that was the end of free listening hour.
Can you remember who brought it in? It must have been somebody who really fancied himself.
Yeah, I could guess. I can picture the most likely one.
That's the kind of thing that you do in order to be able to tell the story about it afterwards, isn't it? I wanted to talk about films, which you touch on in your book. You know a lot of this. Propagating the idea that everybody was at it, you ought to be at it, and so forth, was films very foremost in this, and British films particularly.
Yeah.
And we're looking at pictures, stills here from Michael Caine in Alfie and Barry Evans in Here We Go Around the Mulberry Bush. Tell us about those.
Well, Alfie is fascinating because it was very open about the fact that here was a young man who was taking advantage of women, but there were consequences, and which doesn't usually happen in most 60s films, or not late 60s ones, but Michael Caine has to face consequences, and there's the harrowing scene at the end where one of his many girlfriends has an abortion, and then he has to go back and sort of clear up afterwards. And that's pretty much how the film ends. So for all that Alfie is still trumpeted as the great British, you know, sexual man about town, he ends up almost crying in the flat, faced with, you know, the aftermath of this the abortion. So it's an anti-sex film, really.
But that wasn't the way it was sold, sold as, you know, have this lifestyle, yeah. You know, this... He's a person to emulate.
Yes. And but the subtext is kind of women like to be treated badly, isn't it? Which is astonishing. I mean, how did people react at the time? I saw this film the other day, actually, and I was really, really shocked by how horrible it was and how cynically he manipulates and exploits all these women. You know, but how did people react at the time?
And he calls at least one of his girlfriends it as well. Yeah. Which is a fairly common thing in early 60s films.
Yeah.
It, oh, listen to it. Oh, it's going on again.
Yeah.
People were shocked by just the sort of blatant sexual nature of the film, more than the moral consequences of it. I think. It was just the fact they were talking about sex at all was shocking.
Right.
And then you get to 66, 67. Here we go around the Mulberry Bush, which has got Judy or Sally?
Judy Geeson.
Yeah. And I'm confused about that because Judy's in this one, has to do a topless scene with Barry Evans. Barry. Hated it. Both of them were really embarrassed, wished they hadn't done it. They got pushed into it. And then if the year after that, Judy's younger daughter, Sally...
Sister.
..is in one of the worst films ever made, What's Good for the Goose, starring
Norman Wisdom,
the great sex symbol, who...
but married man has affair with younger...
A married, very sexy man, because it's Norman Wisdom, in his mid-50s... picks up girl hitchhikers aged, well, I think Sally Geeson was about 17 or 18 when she made the film. And, of course, she finds him irresistibly attractive. And who wouldn't?
Well, she's only flesh and blood. Yeah.
Well, exactly, yes. And, I mean, it's just awful. I say in the book, it should be watched by any middle-aged or elderly, in my case, man, who still thinks he's God's gift to women because... you're so obviously not, you know. You only need to see this film to think, oh God, we are ridiculous, it's okay. But she, Sally Geeson, ends up having to do a topless scene that was only used in Europe, not in the UK. And again, she was sort of pushed into it. And I wonder who wrote the script for the film? Norman Wisdom.
Get away. Let's talk about gay, because gay didn't exist in the 60s. No. Literally did not exist.
We were talking earlier about the fact that in the Hunter Davis biography of the Beatles, which came out in 68, he always said that he was forced by Queenie Epstein, Brian Epstein's mother, to take out the revelation that Brian was gay because that hadn't been written about. And so he did take it out to her satisfaction, but he still described Brian Epstein at least twice in the book as being gay. But everybody in Britain, at least who read the book, would have gone, oh, gay, he likes a party. He's happy, you know. Yeah. So there was that sort of verbal... I mean, I presume Hunter Davis, living in the centre of London, maybe he'd been to America where it was starting to be used as a word.
But there was no kind of out gay male screen idol, was there? I mean, Dirk Bogart was possibly, you mentioned several times in the book, in The Victim and the Servant, you know, there are indications that he might be, and he probably had people who related to him as a kind of heterosexual idol, and the gay community felt differently and saw something else in him that connected them. But I mean, before him, I can't really think of anybody who was really a gay screen idol. Was there? No.
Then again, how many can you think of now?
Well, most of them don't trade.
There you go. It's casting opportunities.
Exactly. It limits your careers.
I should say, acting as Dirk Bogart's publicity agent here, that he has always denied being gay. He said that if people want to think he's gay, that's fine, but he's definitely not. Now, in the film Victim, which was revolutionary for the early 60s, in which he is being blackmailed for having possibly made advances to a young man, even in that film, which he was very courageous to take the part. His character isn't gay, but he has gay leanings.
Yeah.
And Dirk was very worried that he would upset his young female fans because I won't say he's like Cliff Richard. He was very, very popular with young women in the 50s with all the Doctor films and things. And so Dirk was worried that this would ruin that image. But in fact, they were just worried because he dyed his hair a bit greyer. And that, so all the letters he got were complaining about that rather than him, you know, him being homosexual.
But gay women were sort of invisible, really, in the 60s, weren't they? Not, something was never really discussed. You know, yeah. It was also not illegal, was it? There's a rumour in the book that it was to do with Queen Victoria. Explain that about Queen Victoria.
But this is the apocryphal story, is that until 1967, it was never illegal to be a gay woman, because Queen Victoria didn't believe that there was such a thing. Now, I've never seen any proof of that, but it's a great story anyway. But it is true that in 1967, when the legislation came in, which finally legalised homosexuality for men, and women as well, presumably, over the age of 21, alone with a single partner, couldn't be in the services, mustn't be in the Merchant Navy. If you qualified with all those things, and it had to be consensual, obviously, then you could have sex if you met all those stipulations. And that was the first time that the law actually acknowledged female homosexuality. And so in 66, if you were a lesbian, you could do whatever the hell you liked. In 67, suddenly, if you're under 21, it was illegal. Mm-hmm. So that, rather than being a liberalisation, it was actually...
Just the reverse.
Stricter.
Let's talk about the kind of how this crosses over with the advent of the so-called alternative society, you know, because I remember I used to go to the rather seedy looking magazine shops in Leeds near City Station. I'll make this confession, just in order to get a copy of IT or Oz, because it was the only place that you could get those kind of magazines. And if you look at those magazines, these are the kind of alternative society hippie magazines of the late 60s. If you look at them nowadays, the thing that strikes you is the amount of nudity in them.
Yeah. And in some cases, I'm ashamed to say, on behalf of rock culture, I'm ashamed to say, underage nudity as well, just sort of tossed in with them, just entirely gratuitous. But on the front cover of Oz, one issue of Oz, was a picture of Germaine Greer there and Vivian Stanshall.
Vivian Stanshall.
From the Bonzo Dog Band. And there was actually a whole series of photographs, in some of which she's topless, and others of which she's just showing a close interest in his trousers.
But it was in those days, you know, it was kind of the... If you go back to Mary Whitehouse, it was... There were two points of view, weren't there? There was let it all hang out... And the other was, for God's sake, put it away, wasn't it? you know what I mean? And it seemed that the forces of light were in favour of let it all hang out at that point. That's how the world felt.
Oh, yes. Yeah, and that's the culture I felt as if I'd inherited in the 70s. Because it was things like Blow Up. It was, what were the other sort of key films of the late 60s? Zabriskie Point.
All these
kind of things where there would be nudity and sex. And it was all part of the rock and roll concoction of, you know, drugs and sex, drugs and rock and roll.
Yeah. So a lot of it, you know, a lot of this stuff only really landed in the mass market, so to speak, in the 70s, didn't it?
Yeah, very much more in the 70s, yeah, definitely. But the strange thing about the 60s, again, looking at these two things, is underground. I would be fascinated to know how much of a popular success the film Blow Up was. Because now, I mean, it seems like it must have been the biggest film of the year.
No, it wasn't.
But I would think at the time it probably played at the Academy in Oxford Street or something.
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, perhaps the Gate at Notting Hill, if that was open then. And that would have been about it. And so the films that we now think of, I mean, even probably Easy Rider at the time as well, the ones that we now think of as being they're encapsulating the late 60s, were underground, and you had to search them out the same way as you had to search out your Oz in
Right.
In Leeds.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I'm sorry, this is maybe distressing for people to look at, even after all this time, but it seemed like you could not get away from John and Yoko naked, you know, in 1969, 70 and so forth.
It's more distressing to listen to.
No, remind us. That's good. Remind us of what, I mean, John Lennon particularly, whether or not it was an art statement or whether or not it was his desire to, for attention seeking and press, which he absolutely loved. But, you know, the things he did, the erotic lithographs, didn't he? There was a movie.
There was a movie called Self-Portrait.
Self-Portrait.
Which was a very focused self-portrait on a particular part of his anatomy. I've never seen
and
it.
And one of the critics says he gave a good performance.
Yes, that's right. Which then got picked up in America and they sort of... I don't think the film was shown in America, but it was probably one cinema. It's never been shown since 69 or 70, I don't think. It's the only one of those John and Yoko films that's never been seen since. But apparently it goes up and down. That's it, in slow motion, just in case you missed any of it.
But you could buy that in record shops.
I think you could. There was supposedly record shops would be prosecuted if they sold that. But I wonder if anybody actually.
They certainly were in America. I think there might have been one case. It's a bit like the Sex Pistols and Warlocks, you know.
Yeah.
There was the one shop, wasn't there, that got done because it had... somebody kick the window of the shop in or something? One of those apocryphal stories again. But certainly in America, the Two Virgins was intercepted by customs and...
Tens of thousands huge of consignments were locked up in the warehouse.
But I suppose nothing gives you a better... idea of the speed of change than the fact that John Lennon, goes from 1963, looking over the balcony at AMI, having his picture taken for the cover of Please Please Me, and then 6 years later, stark naked.
And as you know, in 69, he went back to the same place at EMI with the Beatles and made that photograph, which was going to be the cover of the Get Back album.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes you wonder why he didn't take Yoko up there and they could have dangled over the edge of the parapet there. And that could have been the album cover.
I just want to deal with one these myths that are associated with the 60s. We've already talked about the topless dress, which nobody ever saw, but was always talked about. Bra burning and so forth. You know, all these things, all these cliches that go into history and are just endlessly repeated in movies. Did that ever happen?
I'm trying to remember which beauty pageant in America it was. And there was in 1969, it might have been was there a Miss Universe as well as the Miss World? It was one of those anyway, or maybe Miss America. And there was a early feminist demonstration against women being treated like the ingredients of a cattle market. And one of the East Coast newspapers did a story about it, and they prophesied that, things are going to be burnt, they're going to have a trash can to put things in. And what they were talking about was maybe they would put a bra into the trash can that they were going to set light to as a sort of token of women's oppression. And that then got put in the headline, and it then got reported around the world that women were taking their bras off and burning them. Now, I'm sure somebody in the world has burnt their bra, but the great explosion of bra burning in the feminist movement, it did not happen.
Why do you call it growing up?
Because that seemed to be the message of the 60s, really. Britain was growing up and getting used to sex. And also, the last chapter is about the sex education film called Growing Up, which, unless you bought a DVD from the British Film Institute in recent years, probably none of you will ever have seen. It was made by a guy called Dr. Martin Cole, who was also involved around the same time with the start of the Ann Summers sex supermarkets. And in this film, which he wanted to show to 11, 12, 13-year-olds, not only was the forefront on nudity, there was penetration and there was male-female masturbation. And not surprisingly, although he wanted to show it to schools, not many schools were allowed to show it. And it got banned, and as far as I know, it's still banned. Well, obviously banned from schools, banned from TV. And it just seemed such a perfect 60s artifact that it had to be called Growing Up.
Right, okay. Well, there's the book, Growing Up, Sex in the 60s by Peter Doggett. Thanks very much for coming along and talking about it.
Copies of it available.
Copies
upstairs.
Available. I'm happy.
People
happy
are very
to sign
happily
them.
Signed.
Yep.
Indeed. Absolutely. You know, the perfect Christmas present for if you if you if you if you still got a shockable elderly yes. relative.
If your grandparents are still alive, this is the one to think. This will help finish them off.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.